In a world where no subject seems to be too sensitive to make money off of, telling the story of the world's most horrific serial killers has become a multi-million dollar industry. But unlike fictional stories, the victims in these stories are real, and the trauma they experience can last a lifetime. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to look at society's obsession with serial killers. Does the oversaturation of gory portrayals in the media actually manipulate the public perception of these killers and possibly inspire others? There is no doubt pop culture has a major effect on society. Over the past 70 years, there has been a significant rise in TV shows and films, which include crime.
The 34-year-old killer, Yoo Young-cho, lured women working in massage parlors to his home, killed them with a blunt weapon, mutilated their bodies, and buried them in the mountains in Seoul.
These are the things, the telltale sign of somebody that's going to become a serial killer.
Thousands of films have been made in the last 15 years about fictional and non-fictional serial killers. In fact, the term serial killer itself comes from Hollywood, as prior to the 1970s, they were just known as mass murderers. I guess serial killer did better with focus groups. Or did the term do a better job of dehumanizing an ever-present yet rare threat, thus making an audience not think they or a loved one could ever be a victim? Just like they probably won't meet an alien or a deadly monster from the underworld. But that could be considered a very false sense of security. Now, according to the FBI, there are 25 to 50 active serial killer cases ongoing at any moment in the USA. And the US leads the race with more than 3,000 serial killers throughout its history. This is by far the largest number, with Great Britain coming in second, with 166 killers recorded. So considering the largest amount of media and Hollywood attention comes from the United States, could this have a direct correlation on the large amount of serial killers in the country? Now, to help us look at the media's portrayal of serial killers and what they're getting wrong, we want to bring in Michael and Lynn Matthews. Now, Michael and Lynn produced a documentary on sex crimes and abuse in the military entitled Justice Denied. Michael himself is a survivor of sexual assault in the military. Welcome to you both. Now, Michael, you produced a documentary on sexual assault in the military. Tell us about your work.
Okay, well, you know, I was raped in the military when I was 19. I didn't tell anybody for 30 years. And when I finally came forward in a counseling session and having some problems, I realized that this is a bigger issue than just myself. I always thought it was just me, you know? And then Lynn got involved.
My husband came forward about his rape in the military, and he was going through some counseling and some challenges and struggles. And I said, you know, we're going to get through this, you know, with support and education, we'll figure out how to go forward separately and together. And in that process, my husband made a suggestion about making a documentary. We were up at Sundance Film Festival at the time, working with another filmmaker, Kirby Dick, and producer Amy Zierman, with the documentary, The Invisible War. And when Michael was hospitalized suddenly in Utah during Sundance, he said, oh, I think we should make a film. And I thought, well, that's the morphine talking. And I said, yeah, honey, sure, we'll make a film, no problem. We get home back to New Mexico from Utah. And I thought about it for about a day. And I said, we're going to do this. We're going to make a film. I had no film experience. It's probably better that I didn't know what I was doing, or I might not have attempted it at all. And so I contacted someone in the film community here, which we have a large community. And I reached out to Michael L. Miller. He is the director and I'm the co-director, and I said, we want to do this film. And as it turns out, Michael L. Miller, the director, had made documentaries before. And so I thought he could assist us in, you know, getting, you know, the colorization and just the other parts that need to happen. So anyway, we met with Michael and I provided the subjects. And before I knew it, we were producing a documentary. It's a little rough looking. We had a small budget, but it made it all the way to Amazon. So
yeah,
we got distribution. So
we got distribution on it, and it made its way around. We went to a lot of film festivals with it, and it was an interesting process for novice at the time. But you know, the biggest thing was all the lives that were ruined in you know, in the United States Armed Forces by rape and murder.
Regarding the subjects in the documentary, I was lucky enough to come across two men that were in the military that were survivors of Jeffrey Dahmer. And that was quite interesting. It gave us some insight into serial killers and how they are in all facets of society, including the military, and how sometimes people can really stay under the radar for a really long time. Go ahead.
Well, actually, and I was instrumental in bringing them on board because they were very skitsy. They had a lot of people approach them, being that they were raped by Jeffrey Dahmer. And, you know, it took a lot of talking on the phone, and being a survivor myself, you know, they trusted me more than they trusted other directors and movie producers. So, you know, I got their feet wet into that aspect of it.
Why are so many serial killers also sexual abusers?
I think I'll let Lynn handle that question. She's better qualified.
Why are so many serial killers sexual abusers? That's a very good question. When you look at nature versus nurture, sometimes you can look back into the history of a particular person and you can see how they were raised. Did they have a good attachment to their caregivers? Were they isolated? Jeffrey Dahmer, for example, my understanding is that he had a mother that had depression and that also was not able to nurture him and hold him. And she didn't want anyone else touching him either. So, you know, that can really wear on someone physically and mentally. That's a very poor attachment. And also Jeffrey Dahmer, my understanding is that when he became an adolescent, he was also having questions about his sexuality. And so he had issues around that. And I think his father was probably very unhappy with the road he was taking and basically encouraged him to join the army. As far as sexual assault, if you look back regarding people that are abused, not everybody becomes a serial killer that's been sexually abused and or physically abused in any other way. I think it's probably a multitude of factors. You have to also look at the psychological aspects of an individual. Do they have a personality disorder? Is their familial environment in some type of disarray? Do they have any type of brain damage? Now, there's a lot of other factors that figure into why someone might become a serial killer. It's not that black and white.
So in your view, do you think the United States produces more serial killers than any other countries per capita, or is this really a global phenomenon?
From the readings that I have done and speaking to other people in law enforcement as well, it seems to me that there are serial killers, you know, all over the world, not just in Western countries. I think we have a lot of access to media, to you know, all kinds of media, computers, radio, television, podcasts. So, you know, you hear more about things like this. And also, it seems as though at least American society, if it bleeds, it leads. People love the sensationalism. They love Freddy Krueger and they love Dexter and any other, name some of the other ones, I can't recall. But they're enthralled with, you know, the television characters. I mean, people glorify Dexter. It's like, wow, this guy is a hero. He's like Robin Hood. He's killing serial killers. And in his role, he plays a police officer. So it's, you know, it's kind of an interesting, you know, juxtaposition. And then there's another show called Barry that's on Netflix. You know, you've got a veteran that comes back from either Iraq or Afghanistan, and he wants to be an actor. So he goes out to Hollywood and takes a class. But on his time off, he's a serial killer. So, you know,
a paid serial killer.
Yeah. Boom. So, you know, like I said, we tend to glorify things. There's murderabilia on eBay and on lots of other sites where you can buy, you know, artwork, you know, drawn by, you know, John Wayne Gacy or, yeah, you know, Manson. I mean, so people are sort of enthralled. I mean, you know, look at Halloween. People are glued to their TV sets, you know, watching, you know,
horror of the day,
you know, movies, you know, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy, but it's kind of sad because I believe probably that there's a lot of copycats in a lot of this stuff of the serial killing, you know, just like on the mass murders. I don't know if they consider the mass murderers people serial killers, although they kill more than three people, which is the qualification, but you know, this goes on and on, and a lot of these people who have problems watch this and they want to emulate these other people.
Yeah, I mean, for example, when you look at something like, you know, the Holocaust, is that a serial killer? You know, that's debatable. If you look at the school shootings, look at Parkland High School. The killer was given life in prison because he had some type of neurological issues. Then you look at, I'm trying to think, bear with me a second. Oh, in New Mexico here, we have the West Mesa killer. It seems to be prostitutes that they were finding in graves mostly. And then you go to New York and you've got the Gilgo Beach killer, which was very similar to the West Mesa killer in New Mexico, where you have prostitutes again that were buried along the dunes.
Yeah, in the dunes and in the swampy areas. Yeah.
Is it a sign of a sick society that we both produce so many serial killers and almost seem to idolize them in a weird sort of way?
I don't know if it's sick. You know, more as it is as a fascination to why people do something. I mean, we go back when I was a kid. I remember the movie The Boston Strangler, played by Tony Curtis. I mean, I think we were just fascinated by why another human being would kill so many people. You know, I don't know. What do you think, Lynn?
Yeah, I definitely think there is a fascination with gore. Just like people want to, when you're driving along the freeway and there's a car crash, you know, people are braking, they're looking. Why are they looking? You know, just keep going. But most people, with the exception of myself, will, you know, want to look. There is some kind of fascination with, like I said, blood and gore and guts. Why that is, I really don't know.
We have been speaking with Michael and Lynn Matthews, producers of the documentary film Justice Denied. Now stick around. When we come back, we will continue the conversation on a serial killer obsession. I'm Skynell Hughes with the 360 View.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Is your media a reflection of reality? In a world transformed, what will make you feel safer? Isolation or community? Are you going the right way or are you being led somewhere? Which direction? What is truth? What is fake? In a world corrupted, you need to descend. So join us in the depths, or remain in the shallows.
As a sign the West's Ukraine proxy war on Russia is not going as planned, a new narrative is making the rounds. It's called the Korea Solution. The end of active hostilities and an armistice. Keep in mind, the side considering an armistice seeks to avoid complete defeat. We all know which side that is.
The Chagos Archipelago, home of the Chagosians, Diego Garcia, the largest island in the archipelago, is now the location of a very large U.S. military base.
UK government give our island to the U.S. government to make a military base and just deported all the Chagosan people from their country so they can't return back on the island.
Never?
Never, but we are fighting. That's why we are fighting for the rights of return.
We do not consider that the right of self-determination actually applies to the Chagossians. And on the question of self-determination, the legal advice we've received is actually the Chagossians were not and are not a people.
For me, it's time to move on and see what we can do for the Chagossian community to return back home.
There's no support from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
United Nations don't care about Chagossian people.
Welcome back. Here on the 360 View today, we are going to be discussing the phenomenon of serial killer obsessions. We are joined by a couple who produce a documentary on sexual abuse in the military and their insights into the world of serial rapists and murderers. Welcome back, Michael and Lynn Matthews. You know, for the survivors of sexual assault and of attempted murders, how does healing happen?
Well, I can speak for myself. As the wife of a survivor, I got my own counseling. I reached out to support groups online. There were some female veteran groups that were very welcoming to me. And as a clinician myself, I think there are a lot more resources now than there used to be with respect to sexual assault per se, whether it's the Rape Crisis Center, groups online. You don't even have to leave your house. You can just Zoom, just like we're doing right now. So there are a lot more resources for people. And I think that's the first step to healing, which is being able to tell another person that something happened to you, that you need help. And very often with survivors of sexual assault, it can take 10 years, 15 years, 20 years for someone to feel safe enough to come forward to someone that they trust and share that they are hurting and that they need help. And that's an opportunity at that point to share resources or to assist someone in finding the resources.
I myself was in counseling at the VA in New York at the time. It was after 9/11. We went back and my wife was working for the New York City Fire Department doing counseling. And it brought up a lot of issues for me. I had PTSD and they didn't know I had PTSD. And I was going to the VA for counseling. And the counselor one day, she just looked at me and she goes, "You want to tell me about your rape?" in the middle of a session. And I never told her anything about that. I haven't told anybody my entire 30 years of, afterwards. And I just broke down and I told her everything. And I don't know why. And I asked her later, why did you ask me that question? Did I tell you? She goes, "No, but you were just talking and everything wasn't fitting. And I've seen so many men that were raped in the military that, you know, I just figured I'd throw it out there and see what you do." And, you know, that's the reason I came out. And then I came home one day, I worked on it counseling for a few sessions and had to come home and tell my wife, who was also a counselor. So, you know,
that was an interesting day.
She was like, and I never knew, you know.
Well, I did know that there was underlying depression and anxiety. I was aware of that. As far as
you, and know, you encouraged me to go to counseling.
Right, and I encouraged. Yeah. I said to him, "You know, what's going on? Like, what's bothering you?" And he didn't verbalize anything specific. So I said, "You know, you have this benefit at the VA. You know, why don't you, you know, use it?" So he picked me up from work one evening, and he said, "Honey, I want to talk to you." And that's not something that you usually say. I want to talk to you.
I'm having an affair or something, right?
So, well, exactly. You know, I'm sitting in the car and I'm thinking, I said to him, you know, are you sick? Like, do you have cancer? No. Did you do something illegal? No. Do you have a girlfriend? No. Do you have a boyfriend? No. I think I went through like every question in my own mind. And I was like, oh, okay, great. You know, it's nothing serious. And then when we got home, he sat down and shared with me what had happened. And in some strange way, I was almost relieved to know that there was something that we hadn't talked about together for that was 20 years into our marriage at the time. And I wasn't crazy. And that now there was an opportunity to go forward with some healing.
Do you think things, films and documentaries are cathartic or are they actually triggering?
Why does the universe keep doing this to me?
Police are continuing to investigate a second murder among the elite.
They're calling him the Eat the Rich Killer.
I talked to one of the victims of Jeffrey Dahmer the survivors, and he was quite annoyed, actually, because they don't portray it correctly. You know, he tells some wild, interesting stuff about it that we didn't use in the movie, that Jeffrey Dahmer used to call him when this guy went home back to Arkansas, Billy Capshaw. He used to get phone calls from Jeffrey Dahmer when he was traveling across the country. And he actually told Billy Capshaw that he killed, what was that kid's name? Walsh.
Adam Walsh.
Adam Walsh. Yeah, he killed that. He called him from Florida and said he just killed Adam Walsh in Hollywood, Florida. And, you know, it's really, really bizarre stuff that you know, went on. And he would torment Billy before he was captured. He used to call Billy and torment him all the time on the telephone. It was kind of interesting stuff there. You know, it's like they really enjoy the tormenting their victims. And actually, Jeffrey Dahmer was planning on killing his two victims in Germany. He told that to the Milwaukee police and the FBI. It's in the documents that he mentioned that he raped them. So it wasn't make believe, or it wasn't supposed he did this. He did this, and you know, he actually admitted to it. And you know, actually, there's I know Billy Capshaw was visited by the German police and Interpol, want to know more about Jeffrey because they believed that he had raped and killed some young men in Germany when he was there.
What about interviews like this?
I can't articulate the way that I wish I could what it felt like to be told, because you were raped in your sleep, you are not worthy of dying for the United States of America.
Are these cathartic experiences, since oftentimes victims and family members don't get to talk about what happened to them?
Well, I know one thing. I know for me it was, okay? But I went through a lot of counseling, a lot of prolonged exposure. And, you know, it became very easy for me to talk about what happened to me as a rape survivor. I know for Billy Capshaw, after he did the movie and then came forward more, and now he's doing other speaking engagements, it's becoming easier for him. So yeah, I probably is cathartic, but I'll let Lynn evolve more on that.
For myself, as a clinician, as the spouse of a survivor, I'm fairly comfortable talking about trauma and traumatic events. I think for survivors in general, whether it's the towers falling, 9/11, whether it's Jeffrey Dahmer, I think the more that survivors have an opportunity to share their feelings and tell their story, there is a desensitization that takes place where it becomes easier over time emotionally to share about this.
Yeah, if you think about what we do as a society and how we relate to these rapists, and then eventually a lot of them become killers, is that we let them fly under the radar. It's like the military letting Jeffrey Dahmer go. You know, they had him, they put him in jail, 12 people would still be alive today from that. And if you go off into the college campuses and the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church, you know, if they just would do something about it, it would make a big difference.
Thank you so much, Michael and Lynn Matthews. Our viewers should be sure to check out your documentary, Justice Denied, exposing rampant sexual abuse in the United States Armed Forces. In the case of serial killers, there are three point of views to examine, with the victim often being given the least amount of attention. Most serial killers are able to commit their horrendous acts because prior to their first victim, they were labeled an outcast. Therefore, their crime is not hurting anyone or anything they care about. Serial killers look to the media and Hollywood to give them the attention and boost their own self-esteem, something their prior life before killing offered. Now, the public has an attraction to these stories, mainly because they want to find an answer or reason behind the killer's madness. Rarely are those answers found, and even more fascination endures. Where there is demand, supply is quick to be produced, which produces a high profit. However, it's not just those seeking answers consuming and hoping for more material. Rather, it could also be those serial killers who are looking themselves to become a household name. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.